Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Welcome to Nerdist Podcast number 562, Doctor Who Series 8. Premiere is this Saturday. I should probably do the voice. Doctor Who Series 8 premiere is Saturday, August 23rd on BBC America. It's at 8 p.m. and then at 11 p.m. live, we're going to do the After Who show. And we're going to have a lot of exciting guests that are relevant to your interests. And we're going to talk about the Series 8 premiere, where Capaldi comes in and crushes it as the Doctor. And it's super fun. Super fun. Watch. We'll be there. We'll take your questions. This is probably the last after show I'm going to do, so let's all be okay with that. I think you're probably fine with it. You know what? You don't think about it most of the time. That's just me. That's just me saying that, because I'm being a narcissistic comedian. This episode is my British pal, Adam Buxton, who is, as I said, a British comedian fellow who was on a show called The Adam and Joe Show on BBC. He was in Hot Fuzz. He's been on a ton of panel shows. His Twitter is at Adam Buxton with an X. But he's a damn hell of a nice guy, and we enjoyed nerding out with him because he actually listens to the podcast. It's really great when people come on who know the podcast. It's just like instant shorthand. So we enjoy him. He will soon be your friend as well. Adam Buxton, episode number 562, Nerdist Podcast. Start the thing!
Now entering Nerdist.com.
How you doing, Ray?
Hey.
You're wearing your Onetters button.
I am.
No, it's Wonders.
Yeah, Wonders. No, it's Onetters.
Adam Buxton, welcome to the podcast. I assume Kitty's already recording. That's how
this shit
goes.
Rolling.
Yeah, I know. This is how it works. Hey, man, we don't have time. We don't fucking time in America.
Quite right.
I don't know what you guys are doing over there, but we don't have time. Shut up, John. I don't have time for that.
You do like a show every night of the week, and you have done since January. Is that right?
Well, four nights a week.
So are you, be honest with me, are you having a breakdown?
You guys aren't here, right? You're all just extensions of my breakdown, right? I'm sitting in an empty room right now, which is really a padded room.
I'm your liver. Haven't recovered yet, Chris.
I'm sorry about 2003 and before.
So am I.
I feel like every 6 weeks I kind of have a, I don't know
a little
where
dip.
I am, but then but
a little
then
crying
okay.
fit. Is it like broadcast news?
You sit, on, hell?
You sit on the bed.
Oh, no, not broadcast news. I was thinking of, what's the network? I was thinking of
network. Network, yes.
Yeah, that kind of meltdown.
No, I'm thinking of Holly Hunter sitting on the bed and just weeping.
Oh, just weeping openly. Yeah. And then I also tuck my jacket down. I actually do that. When I'm sitting down on a show,
yeah.
You tuck the jacket
That's
down.
That's a top tip, isn't it? But you don't suffer from flop sweat, presumably. Like,
no.
What's his name did on that? What's the name of the actor?
William Hurt.
William Hurt. Yes.
Was exactly. William Hurt.
Nice. Oh, no. But it was. William Hurt is the smooth anchor on that film. But the guy who gets the flop sweat is.
It's not Albert Brooks, is it?
There you go.
Yes, it is Albert Brooks.
Yeah.
Nemo!
What are you doing in America?
Oh,
welcome to our country.
Thanks very much. I came here for this.
No, you did not. Not endure that flight for this.
Oh, tell me about enduring the flight, mate. That is a nightmare of a flight. I was thinking to myself, I would not be good if a real crisis happened in the world, or indeed in my life, because I barely made it through that 12-hour flight. And this is a 12-hour flight that really went without incident. It was on time. No one died. No one got arrested. But I was traumatized by it. It was just, I couldn't deal with it. And it was full for a start. And it's so sort of dark and grim in there. And the smell in the restroom
after 12 hours
just became it was something weird happened in there. After a while, like in the last 3 hours, I went in there to brush my teeth in the morning. But when you sort of think, oh, we're in the last section, I'll brush my teeth, and that'll make me.
You don't want to open your mouth in there,
no,
because that's where it gets in.
I went in there, and there was fluid pooling around on the base of this thing, and it smelt as if someone had gutted an old fish in there. it was unholy, the smell in there. And then I was faced with the problem of, like, what do I do now? I don't want to go out and then have the next person think that
it was
I'm
you.
Responsible for this unholy gutted fish smell. And I talked to Todd Barry about this, actually. I don't know why I thought he would be the person to ask, but I said, what would you do in this situation? And he said, well, I was going to do my Todd Barry impression there. But then,
hey, man. Hey, man.
I suppose I would. That's more like Clint Eastwood. he said, well, you just sort of go out and say, it's pretty rough in there.
Right.
Yes.
And as if you're sort of saying, well, it's nothing to do with me, but good luck kind of thing. But this was beyond that. So I thought the only option available to me was to clean it up.
No.
I think you go the opposite direction.
Really?
You kick the door open into the line of people. You go, see? Don't fuck with me! and then not only...
So this flight is like prison to you. He should have done that in the beginning of the flight, just lay it out there.
You tried to clean up?
Yeah. I got the soap dispenser that dispenses that worthless kind of foam.
The foam, yeah.
And I put as much of the worthless foam on the floor as I could. And then I just covered, I made a carpet of paper towels. And then I made sort of paper towel gloves for my hands in order to deal with the...
Your flight should have been free. You know, you're working for the airline at this point.
I tell you, honestly, it was awful.
You're too nice.
And then, so I cleaned it up. It was a little bit better, but it was still grim.
So then you went to the hospital and got shots after that, right?
That's where I'm going after this, yeah. And then the other thing was that I had that cruel moment at the beginning when I got on board this very busy flight. I went and found my seat, and there was a lady there sort of looking disappointedly at me because she was hoping that maybe the seat next to her would be free.
Mm.
So I sat down, and then she sort of looked behind, and the two seats behind us were free. So she was like, there's a couple of free seats there. And I said, yeah, all right, I'll give it a go. So I sat there, and it looked as if it was going to work. You know, they were closing the doors. They were doing the announcements for please take your seats, you know, where we're about to take off, and all this kind of stuff. And I was thinking, this is amazing. Because it's like being first class. If you've got a free seat next to you, it's just a holiday.
Yeah.
And at the very, very last minute, this old couple got on and shuffled back.
At the very last minute, a family of hyenas got on board. Yeah. Carrying a box full of babies.
So it was.
Which part was more impressive?
were they sweet babies?
Yeah, just loud. Okay. Just loud. Just loud babies.
Actually, that was the only thing that wasn't happening was there was no screaming of toddlers. But other than that, it was just grim.
Yeah, it's a tough... The 12 hours... The 12-hour back... It's only 9.5... It's like 9.5 over 11 or 12 back.
Right.
So it's not... It'll be quicker by a little bit
when
you go back.
Also, I don't mind the nighttime one is not so bad for me because, you know, then your body just gives out after a while and you mm-hmm. have to... You sleep for at least a couple of hours and that breaks the back of it somewhat. But I was awake for the whole... You know, I got on the plane at 3 in the afternoon, UK time. I was awake right through the whole thing, every single minute.
I've been up on movies, though.
I've seen them all. Saw them all. I saw the documentary about the backing singers, 20 feet from
Stardom, yeah.
I like that. That's a good one.
Too bad it wasn't 12 hours long.
I know. I could have handled a lot more. But to answer your original question, sorry for the tangential reply there.
No.
I came here a few months back to do South by Southwest and then ended up doing some stand-up shows in New York and LA. And at the show, one of the shows I did in LA, a few of my friends came along and brought this guy, Chris Holmes, who I think, you know, he's a DJ and sort of scenester here in LA, for those who don't know him.
He's a Zelig of the alternative music scene.
Right. I don't know if he'll appreciate being called a scenester, but I think if anyone is a scenester, Chris Holmes.
Yes, yes. He was that guy that was supposed to DJ my wedding, but then had to cancel because he had to DJ for Paul McCartney.
There you go.
Oh, yeah. Right.
It's a good excuse.
Yeah, it's still not a good excuse, in my estimation.
The other guy that I had as
a DJ for Paul...
He's the opening DJ for Paul McCartney around the world.
Fucking kidding me?
No.
He just opens for Paul McCartney as a DJ? Yeah.
And I think that a large part of his set is playing Beatles covers that are in the language of whatever country Macca happens to be playing at. So it'll be Brazilian Beatles covers if he's in Brazil, etc.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's insane. It's insane. It's
cool. All right, so...
Yeah, it was all happenstance because of he was doing a party at Coachella, and Nigel Nigel Godrich, the producer of
Radiohead,
was there and then recommended him. And then Chris was driving one day and got a phone call, and he's like, "Hello, Chris, this is Paul McCartney." And he's like, "Shut up,
fuck you! Yeah, is this, you dumb piece of shit?"
Yeah.
No, really, it's Paul McCartney.
Yeah, you've been highly recommended from Nigel.
Came along, not Macca, but Chris Holmes. And he really liked the show, and he said, "You've got to come back to LA, and I'll fix up some more shows for you." You know, which is exactly what I wanted to hear, because I love coming to the States, but I'm not going to be able to fund it myself every time I want to do it.
No, it's not.
Which I did last time. You know, I got myself out to South by Southwest because I was pleased to be invited to do something there. But after a while, it stops being economically viable.
And also energy viable. Like it's a tough slog, because touring is hard enough as it is. But touring when you're going, you know, when you're having to fly over to a different continent and then and then start doing shows.
Yeah, exactly. Especially if no one knows you. I mean, I'm a sort of a cult concern in the UK, let alone in America. There's very few people who know me over here.
I don't know. You have a nice little Twitter following behind your belt, Adam Bucks. There's a nice little... people are aware of you. You do the good panel shows.
Thanks very much. I'm carving out... You know, I'm trying to carve out little niches here and there. It'd be great if I had a few hundred people that I could play to as an excuse to come out to the States every now and again. You know what I mean? And so that's the idea.
That's kind of fun. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm going to do a show. I'm doing little spots. I'm doing a spot at UCB tonight.
Nice.
How big is UCB in LA?
99 seats.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, about 100. How about they can
squeeze in a little bit more.
In a little bit more. Yeah. Unless you're a fire marshal, then they're not squeezing any more in. But really, it's usually like 120.
Just the seats that are there allocated for the people.
Yeah, you should do Meltdown too.
Yes. Oh, I'm going to do Meltdown on Wednesday.
Oh, good.
Very excited. Yeah.
That'll be fun. And you'll love it. You'll love both of the venues.
Yeah. Are you going to be there on Wednesday?
Probably not, because we...
Double shows.
Yeah, we do two shows on Wednesdays for at midnight, and so I usually don't leave until 10 p.m. Mm-hmm. on Wednesdays, so I'll miss the...
You'll be there, right, Jonah?
Yes, I host the show, so I'll
excellent
be there.
Excellent
stuff. You'll be there. Is Kumail going to be there?
Kumail will be there. We're excited.
It's funny. Yeah. I think you and I are in the same but opposite positions, which is where... Not that many people know me in England, and it's really only because of the podcast and maybe Talking Bad. But when I went out there last year, I played the Leicester Square Theater, and I think, you know, like, it was enough. It was like 300 people or something. It was like it was a fine amount.
That's good, man. Yeah.
So
I mean, I did a show at the Atwater Theater the last time I was out here, out in Los Feliz, right?
Yeah, so Atwater Village.
Yeah, and that's about 900 people or something in there, and that was mainly people that I'd. You know, got to come along.
Yeah.
But I feel like with British, it feels like with British stand-ups, this thing happens where it's like, oh, I'm doing these pub shows, or I'm, you know, I just did like a 300-seat venue, and then I was on TV, and I'm playing the O2 this Friday. Like, so, you have so many people that actually play arenas in England.
Yeah. Well, that's a certain kind of comedy. That's not my sort of stuff. My stuff is like a kind of a stupid TED talk, really. It's all off my laptop, and so... The jokes are all incorporated into there, and it's very much not the kind of arena filling stuff that's going on in the
UK. Also, because of the screen, though, it's kind of a small venue thing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it works in a big venue as long as they've got a big screen.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. So, like, I did some shows for a couple of thousand people in London, but they were good because they had a massive, great screen on stage, and it works fine. You know,
but that also makes some shows that, like, the problem you ran into with Hard and Firm, where it's like. Once you say, oh, I need a projection and a screen, and then they go, well, now the theater costs this much for you.
Right, exactly.
It's really expensive to, when you start adding stuff in venues here, unless it's just like a rock club where it's like, fucking set it up yourself. But if it's like a proper theater, They're like, oh, a screen, that's an extra $1,200.
Yeah, we got to bring in that guy.
Yeah, we have to bring in this guy, and we have to get this equipment. And then all of a sudden, it starts getting really expensive. So it's
that's
hard.
Right.
It's hard to do it a lot.
Well, the best thing is to do cinemas, of course. Mm-hmm. Did you do a lot of cinema shows?
No, but there are some good cinema venues. The is it the Baghdad in Portland? Or the
Baghdad has a theater.
Yeah.
And then like the draft houses that are starting to pick up around the States, but not too much. I mean, there's not too many places.
Did you do Largo?
No.
Largo.
Do they have a screen?
I thought they... Doesn't he have a screen back there?
I don't know.
Oh, maybe not.
I mean, I brought a projector with me. Like last time, because I went to New York and I was doing UCB there. And UCB East.
Mm-hmm.
And so went down, but I got the thing, which I often get sometimes if I'm playing smaller venues and people haven't got no idea, you know, they've got no idea who I am, of just a look of absolute disgust on the face of the technician when I went in and said, where do I plug in my laptop? He's like, what? And
they're used to just doing lights out at the end of an improv
scene.
Yeah,
exactly. And the attitude is very much like, well, you should write some jokes, you stupid twat.
I have.
There are these bells and whistles, friend.
So then I was supposed to be doing two nights there, so I couldn't do my set on the first night because they hadn't got the memo about me plugging in my laptop. But the next night, took along this little tiny projector that I've got, which turns out to be amazing, and it totally did the job. So I just set it up on one of the seats in the audience, got one of the audience members to hold it so it didn't fall over during the set. And I was sorted. It was great.
Was it like a little Pico projector, just like a tiny little?
An Optima, it's called. And it's just for doing little, you know, office presentations.
God. Furman and I, when we used to do Hard and Firm stuff, we had a giant, the smallest projector I could find in 2004 was a quite large projector that was very cumbersome. And it's like, well, then you have to have this, and then you had to have a DVD player to hook up to it.
That's right.
And then that's got to, you know, then you have to.
It gets so hot.
Then you got to do like XLRs into the sound system. And then you need a converter for that.
Yeah.
And then a screen. We had a fucking screen we would carry around. Like it was a full on.
You had a screen. I carry a sheet with me now.
That's good.
Every now and again, you will need, you know, you'll get to a venue and it'll all be fine in the email kind of thing. But when you get there, they're like, or maybe they've got like a little white sheet of A4 paper or something. And they're like, hey, you can use that as a screen.
Most venues, I think, don't communicate in any way with the people where you can lay out in detail, and I need this and I need this work, and you show up and you're like, yeah, no one told me anything.
But yeah.
Really, not one. They could have just forwarded you the...
There's this crazy thing that just happened up in Portland where like Lance Bangs was going to show some videos at this venue, and he went like three times within the coming days before the show. He's like, hey, I just want to make sure this is what we're going, this is where my show, I'm going to have this, the projector, and the guy's like, got it. And then so it comes time, and he's like, all right, now we have a video, and it's nothing's working. And the guy's like, I don't know what's wrong. And like, he's like, but we talked about it. He's like, I don't know. And so Lance is running around trying to show this clip of one of the last videoed Mitch Hedberg sets.
Oh.
And Lance was on one that the last tour they did. And it's like, and it's this video of Mitch trying to like get the mics to work at this show in Portland, where he's like trying, like he's like they keep on cutting out. He has to keep on doing it. He's kind of flipping out and kind of yelling at the guy, kind of making fun of the guy, and then like, you know, on the ground, Mitch Hedberg just doing like, you know, kind of having this meltdown about this guy that's just fucking him up. And then the guy at the venue who's watching that going, "Hey, was this in Portland?" And the Lance goes, "Yeah." He's like, "Yeah, I was the sound guy at that show."
Shit.
Not understanding the coincidence. He's like, oh yeah, it's red. I remember that. And like not getting that the same thing's happening all over again.
Oh my God. I'm glad it happens to other people, not just me.
Yeah.
Because it is. I mean, it's constant aggro, really. And I mean, I was at the Atwater Theatre. They were very nice at the Atwater Theatre, lovely venue as well. But I'd gone in the day before just to make sure everything was going to be okay and try and circumvent any problems and anticipate them. And we'd got everything sorted. It was all going to be fine and figured out a kind of lighting state and everything. And then, unbeknownst to me, the people helping me arrange the thing had booked an opener. And so he came on and did his little 15 minutes before me or whatever. And then when I came on, all the lighting state was totally different. And so, and you know, when I come on, I sort of sing a song at the beginning. And so I had to kind of stop the song and say, we need to turn all those lights off because you can't see the screen. And do you remember, we went through it yesterday. Remember yesterday? It was in the afternoon. I spent an hour. I was the guy who was here for an hour yesterday.
No, same guy, same face, same name even. Same person.
And he'd gone. The guy had gone. And he'd left someone else in charge.
So
they were sort of starting, they were like shaking their head at me and going through the window.
Yeah, I'm getting such severe flashbacks to when I used to tour with Mike Furman for Hard and Firm. And I started to get to, I mean, though some of those moments can become some of the best moments of your show.
Yes, well, people who came to the show said that was the bit they enjoyed best. It was me arguing. One of the bits, they.
But at a certain point, you're just like,
yeah, exactly. No, because I was incandescent with rage. Because I was so, you know, I fucking cycled all the way down there the day before, cycling through LA, you know, with a giant backpack on my back, looking like a massive Wally. And got to the place and gone through the hassle of figuring all this out and everything. And then it was totally out the window. So I was really furious. I felt like a twat. I was all ready to just do the show and do it nice and smoothly. And it was that thing where the first 5 minutes is semi-funny when you're arguing and saying, yeah, no, not like that. just take that one off and switch all those. Yeah, no, switch them right off, switch them all off. Yeah, no, not the orange one. I hate orange. switch it off. So it was sort of semi-amusing for 5 minutes, but then it goes on for another 5 minutes. And then by that time I was getting really, really angry. And then they turned the mic right down because there was something else happening in the space next door. I was like, why? Oh, the mic's gone. Where's the mic gone? And they were like, oh, we got to keep it low because there's something happening next door.
Oh.
And then I went, and then with what volume I had in the mic, I just went, Jesus Christ! and then they were going, don't do that. And you don't want to communicate your rage to the audience. You don't want to infect the audience with your fury.
No, because then they'll get uncomfortable.
Exactly, then it'll bum them out and they'll have a horrible time.
Mom and Dad are fighting, everyone's like, no.
So I was trying to keep it light, but it was very difficult.
And ultimately, it all worked
ultimately,
out
ultimately, it was good. Yeah, it was fine.
Well, I have so many of those stories, but one of my favorites was, you said you played Radiohead on the radio at some
point, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. So Furman and I, when we first started doing Radiohead, we actually had a full band, and we were playing it live, but it was very expensive to do that because we had to pay everyone. So then we decided, let's just pay them once. We'll shoot them in a recording studio playing backup, and then we'll do a bunch of After Effects and make it look like a CNN, like we've live via satellite.
Like the Gorillaz used to do with their...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then we put all this dumb fake news crawl with a bunch of dumb non-sequiturs at the bottom. And by the way, people still were like, how did you get a satellite uplink? We're like, you didn't notice the bottom where it says, like, you know... sharks are walking the streets of New York or whatever stupid thing it was. Like, they just didn't even pay attention.
What's funny about that, though, is like, I remember seeing you do that and being like, oh, what a cool idea. And it never once occurred to me like, oh, this was a fix for you guys to try.
It was just a fix.
Simplify.
So the way that it would work is we had a dialogue that we had set up with the band a pre, and so, you know, we would go, well, so a lot of people don't know that this is happening live via satellite. Can you guys prove it? And then Lee Farber, the drummer, goes, oh, actually, I brought a newspaper. And I go, Lee, what is data in the newspaper? And he looks and he goes, today's. And we're like, great. And so we go through this whole thing that's like a 5-minute setup. And then we get into Radiohead and we're halfway in and we're performing at the Hotel Cafe on Cahuenga. And I turn and my foot kicks the plug of the projector out.
Oh,
and
mate.
The DVD player and everything. It's like, kick the power cord out.
It's the nightmare scenario.
And it just, ew. We're playing over silence for like a second, and then we just stop. Gotta plug it back in. Fast forward to the whole thing where it's like acquiring signal, find the spot, walk people. It's like,
so today's date.
Yeah, the magic is basically like the sawing the lady in half. The full lady fell out of the box. We had to put her back in and be like, no. Her legs are still here and her torso is still here. Yeah.
And there's absolute silence while you're doing it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for us, though, we sort of thrived in that environment. So it was fun, but it was just one of those, like, God
damn it.
When it
happens to me, there's absolute silence. That's happened to me a couple of times. One time I had a ridiculous thing where the bottom, like, you know, sometimes when you plug in your laptop to someone else's projector, you know, the resolution changes.
Yeah.
And so all the documents, like I had a Photoshop document open that I wanted to go through. and the bottom of the document was no longer grabbable. It was no longer on the screen because the resolution changed. So it was off the desktop. And so I got halfway through this presentation with this Photoshop document, and then I realized that in a couple of moves' time, I was no longer going to be able to do it because I couldn't fucking move it down. And I didn't know how to zoom it so that everything would fit back onto the desktop. And so I thought, oh, God, am I going to carry on and just ignore it? Or, and I thought, no, I'm not. So I explained to the audience what had happened, and they all went quiet. And I said, so I don't really know what I'm going to do now, because that's mainly the rest of the presentation. So I was wondering if there's any IT people in the audience that might have an idea of how to get beyond this. And so the audience laughed. I said, no, I'm not joking about that. I would genuinely appreciate some IT support. And so three people from the audience came up one after the other, and all of them unable to fix the problem. And the audience were all cheering each time one of them came up, and it was just awful. I think they enjoyed themselves, but I was so mortified that at the end of the show I said, listen, this was bad, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to put on a free show for you. So if you want to come to a free show, write your names down, write your email address down, and I'll get in touch with you. Sort of thinking that very few people would, and every single person, like 300 people, did. So then I had to spend the rest of the night, I remember, just trying to read people's handwriting. It took me like 3 hours to get all these emails down. Then I had to figure out how to do a mass email mail out, and it was an absolute nightmare.
That's very, you know, so what I'm getting from you so far is that you're very thoughtful. You'll clean dirty airplane bathrooms.
Yeah.
You'll put on free shows when the resolution...
Well, it's sort of... it's a little bit of mental illness in there, isn't there, really, I think? Because a lot of those things are...
That was you putting soap and towels on the audience to try to fix the...
Yeah. Yeah, I don't want... I can't handle... I'm trying to fend off the moment when you read some negative comment on Twitter or online about the show. You know
mean
I
mean all the time? Because that's what happens
that's
all the time.
That's why they made it. Did you hear? That's what the founders of Twitter said. Oh, this is just... We made this so people can make other people feel bad.
Yeah.
They finally admitted it.
Well, I think it's... I really think those can be, like I said, some of the most magical moments, and I think stuff not going according to plan. I mean, at a certain point, it can be devastating, but I think those create really special moments that people take away, rather than when everything goes off without a hitch.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of agree with you, but there are times when you have put so much work into the presentation that you want it to go without a hitch.
Of course, yeah,
and
of
you
course.
Think that has its own charm. You know what I mean? There are little pockets that you build into the show where you can veer off the tracks a little bit and stop it from being just a totally rote presentation. But I agree with you, though, that they, I mean, audiences do seem to like it when things genuinely fuck up.
Because that's what that I think that's what makes live performance so great, is that it is this kind of unique, intimate experience.
Mm.
And, you know, the more special things that happen in that one moment, then people don't feel like, oh, this is the same thing that happens every show.
Yeah.
You know, oh, this is a shared experience that we're all having right now.
Yeah.
So I think it bothers you way more than it bothers
probably
the people who are actually there.
I heard your podcast the other day with Divine Fitz, where you were talking about the notion of comedy being like a magic show rather than rock and roll being like a something that you wanted to hear over again. Well, you know, with comedy, once the audience have seen the trick, that's it, kind of thing. It doesn't bear rewatching the same way that music does.
I think that's mostly true. Yeah,
yeah, I think you're right. I hadn't heard it expressed that way before, but I've often thought to myself that it's kind of unfair and annoying that it doesn't work the same way. I mean, I do think it's weird, though. You must have a lot of people that come to your shows more than once and are happy to see you doing the same set.
I get so self-conscious. Like, yeah, there are some people that... I mean, I just did 5 shows in Salt Lake City, and there were people that I saw at more than one show. But and so I feel bad. Like, I check in with them. I feel bad, like, getting into some of the same punchlines. And so I go, okay, they're laughing. But it's part of the reason why, like, 40% of my show is just talking to the audience, because I know that even if you see the same show more than once, it's never exactly the same.
Yeah.
Like, there's still a different experience about each one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there is that, you know, the... the comedy relies on the aha moments, and once people know that moment, then it's hard. It can be hard, but.
And you want to, like, you know, have like an honest back to your, like, you know, your material. And so when you do that thing in a bit where you're like, you kind of you do that thing where you act out like you're finding the joke or you laugh at it, something, you
right?
Know, those kind of things that you, it happened once organically and it got such a good response that you tend to make that moment happen over and over.
You become
again.
Skilled at recreating it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then when you know that someone's seen that exact, like, well, isn't that weird that, you know, you kind of come up with this thing that seemingly is.
But I think I maybe I'm totally wrong about this, but I sometimes feel as if that's part of the fun for them is analyzing how it's all fitting together. And
some people
and
really do like that. Someone came to the Thursday show, and I started developing a new little chunk. And then in the last show on Saturday, she said, "Oh, it was really interesting to watch this thing start as an idea on Thursday." And then I remembered watching in San Francisco, watching a couple different Chappelle shows. And watching one bit sort of accidentally pop out on one night, and a few nights later it was a fully formed bit, and I was like, "Whoa!" Like,
oh, that's true.
I totally loved watching that process. Some people, some specific comedy nerds, it's a very specific bunch, but there are a handful of people that really do kind of enjoy that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think so. And then you have the converse thing where you say something that goes down really well one night and then you try and do it again and it just never works again. And it's so frustrating. And you keep trying to hammer it again. You think, well, I'm gonna do that bit again and see if that... Because there was that one glorious night when it went so well.
Chasing the comedy dragon.
And it never happens. And eventually you just think, oh, it's time to kill you.
So when did you start doing... When did you actually start doing stand-up?
Well, I mean, I hesitate to call it stand-up.
Performance.
You know, I mean,
when did you start performing live?
Yeah, performing live... 2005. Mm-hmm. Before then, I'd always just made videos with Joe Cornish, my comedy partner in the UK, now known to some as a movie director. Attack the Block was his debut feature.
Yep, great movie. That one did all right.
Yeah. And
the
you know,
writer of Ant-Man, kind of.
That's right. Part of I'm not as up on my Ant-Man drama as I should be. I know that there's.
I just said the other night on Twitter. I was like, "Fuck it, I'll direct Ant-Man." Who gives a shit? and then
I was there in place already.
Yeah, and then I had a hashtag yes Hardwick can't man. And then people are like, "Wait, so does that mean you can't direct it, or you can?" Yeah.
So
you should direct it. You direct it.
I'll direct it. I could do it way better than Edgar. Edgar Wright, he's a moron.
But the camera, just swish it from side to side.
Yeah, exactly. Put a few. stick some groovy music on the top, bongo. So Joe and I used to just make videos, really, and we were kind of teleheads. That's how we got into the whole entertainment world, was being fans and doing a sort of show that was like Wayne's World, but real, really. We made it all ourselves, and we did four series of this thing called The Adam and Joe Show on Channel 4, and it was full of movie parodies and TV parodies that we used to do with toys and Star Wars figures and things like that. You know?
You said it was kind of inspired by Jake Fogelman's show.
Yes, well, a friend of ours, Louis Theroux, who actually I'm staying with Louis out in LA. He was working in New York for Spy magazine for a while, and then on Michael Moore's show TV Nation that he used to do. And so he was our you know, pipeline of amazing, cool US stuff. And he sent us this tape of Jake Fogelnest's show, Squirt TV.
Squirt TV, MTV show, former MTV show.
Yeah. Right. And he sort of said, "Look, you see, this is what you should do. You should do, like, you should pull," because we were working on trying to figure out a good format for all our little bits and pieces. But we could never figure out how it would work. And he just said, "Just do it in your flat, you know." And watching that and how funny that was gave us the confidence to sort of go
YouTube
ahead.
YouTube before YouTube, really.
Yeah.
I mean, that public access. Squirt was public access, wasn't it?
It was public access first.
Yeah. And then MTV snatched it.
Right. Yeah.
But that idea of, you know, it was much harder to, like, "Oh, I'll just make my own thing," before there were really simple ways to do that technologically. Like, "Oh, now you got to have all the equipment."
Yeah.
big clunky equipment. How do we get, where do we put it? Do we upload it? Our connection's really bad. This is going to be expensive when people start downloading this.
Yeah, we didn't have to worry about the internet when we were doing our stuff. I think I only started getting email in about 1998. I was a fairly late adopter. And so anyway, we did our TV show for a long while, and then it kind of, I don't know, we sort of stopped, and we got to a point in the UK where we were dipping our toes in the mainstream a little bit, but we were still very culty, you know, late night on Channel 4 in the UK.
Great channel.
Yeah, fantastic channel. We were on at the same, and so that's how we got to know Edgar and all that lot, Edgar Wright, because they were doing Space at the same time. So we were sort of going to the same parties kind of thing.
Yeah.
And seeing all the Little Britain people, and I mean, they weren't doing Little Britain then, but they would do, and all that.
Also, the Iowade Wholeness guys, right?
They were a little bit younger than us. But we were seeing like the Boosh and people like that. You know, they were more our generation. But it was all, you know, the kind of Chris Morrissey,
yeah,
Amando Iannucci. They were a little bit older, but. Graham Linehan was a, you know him? Like, yeah. He wrote Father Ted with Arthur Matthews. And
follow Graham on Twitter.
Yeah. And he did a show called Big Train. Have you seen Big Train?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's a great sketch show, which we wrote a couple of sketches on that, me and Joe. Uh-huh.
And you worked on Look Around You.
I was in an episode of Look Around You. Yeah, that's right. And Robert Popper was a big, Peter Serafinovich and Robert Popper were very sociable. And so they were, and very enthusiastic, you know, and they were sort of those people who catalyze a lot of things and get people enthused. And Robert Popper used to have a kind of video night where people would go around and just show weird videos that they had, you know, again, like YouTube before YouTube.
Yeah,
kind
exactly.
Of thing. So there was all that going on. It was really good fun. But then we didn't really know what to do after, you know, we didn't know how to move on from just doing this homemade TV show. We didn't want to go totally mainstream and start doing panel shows and stuff. So we did a few strange things that didn't really work and then kind of drifted off in our own separate ways. The thing that saved me and Joe eventually was radio and later on podcasting. That's how we managed to maintain our relationship. But as far as TV was concerned, it was too exhausting, you know, just because we made it all ourselves, it put a real strain on the friendship.
Yeah, that.
Because it's such hard work and you're in... And you had no sense of whether anyone was watching the thing as well, you know, pre-internet. You just thought, we're making this like in a vacuum, you know.
Well, also, and then there's also compromises in terms of, you know, what you think the joke is supposed to be and how it's going to be presented and who your audience is. And, oh, I kind of want this, but oh, I want this and I want to, this is for this people and these are for these people and we have to... You know, you start getting really personal about...
You get very precious and you argue about pathetic things that are, you know, masking more serious underlying issues. You end up arguing about, like, which games console is the best and things like that. We had a big argument about whether the PS3 was better than the SNES or something. And we almost ended up crying at the end of that one.
So who won?
So I think, well, I think Joe stormed out.
So you won.
So in a way I won, yeah. I beat him. Yeah.
I mean, that's basically like getting him out of the sumo ring right there is what that is. I think you get the point on that
that's
one.
That's right. I think that's what his whole Hollywood career has been, is just him trying to rub my face in it to get me back for the PS3 argument to show...
At the end of the credits of just like Attack the Block, I was like, right. Which side were you? Were you PS3 or were you?
I was SNES.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I think he was probably right. He's usually right. And I think that's probably part of the argument was that I was annoyed with the fact that he was right again.
You're going to get these weird phone calls in the middle of the night. Ring, hello.
PlayStation. Like,
no. Please.
But yeah, so we kind of drifted off for a while. And then around about 2005, I was... I just thought, God, I've got to do something else. Otherwise, I'm just going to crawl up my own arse and do nothing. I did some ridiculous, pointless waste of time things. Like for a while, I was obsessed with DVD commentaries. And when they first started coming out, I got it into my head that it would be a brilliant TV show to do like a MST3000 DVD commentary. Because, like, in the UK, not many people know about MST3000. Yeah. And I thought someone is going to do a show where they do fake DVD commentaries, and that'll be. And you can go off and you can be really creative within it, you know. And you can go to the extras menu, and you can have little fake EPKs, and you can do all sorts of things. You can have different people coming in on the commentary, and you do it MST style with stuff that's out of copyright, you know.
Yeah.
And I shopped this idea around for a while, and I did it with a couple of shows, like crap shows in the UK, just to give people an idea of how it would work. And it took months doing it. And then a guy, Rob Brydon, have you ever heard of him? He's brilliant. He's very funny, and he does a show called The Trip with Steve Coogan.
Oh yeah, yes.
Which I put on your drive, incidentally.
I made you guys a
selection of stuff that you may or may not have seen to put on your computers.
Yeah, it's on that drive.
Like documentaries and things that I like.
I put
The Trip on there, which I like.
The first trip or the new
trip? The Trip to Italy.
Oh, awesome. I haven't seen
that. Yeah, it's good. Anyway, he's super talented, Rob Brydon. But he beat me to the punch on that thing, on the commentary thing. And so I was just like, oh, fucking hell, I've got to do something else. And so I thought, well, the only thing left to do is like live performing, as I've never done that before. So I went off to Edinburgh and did a show I was playing a character, kind of Russian animator, which mainly gave me an excuse to crowbar in some of the stupid videos. Like I made a video of an episode of Pokemon that was all desaturated and grainy and had I'd redubbed it so that it was all weird and Eastern European, like a it was like a kind of Svankmajer thing. So the show was really an excuse to get those bits in.
Did it work well at Edinburgh?
Yeah, it worked fine, I think. Yeah, it did. It worked really well. And actually, Graham Linehan helped me write some jokes for that, and so it was good, but it was pretty hard work, and I still wasn't any good at like doing stuff as myself. You know what I mean? Like I had to do character stuff.
Are you better at that? Because you do the panel shows as yourself.
Yeah. No, I'm fine now. And I say I'm fine. I'm still pretty ropey because I don't do them very often. So I always. Like sometimes you can see I still have that slightly scared look, which.
But you just hosted some awards show. You emailed and you said, I'm backstage. I'm at an awards show.
Yeah, I do a few awards shows and I quite like doing them. But that was a difficult one. That was, what was that one? Oh, yeah, that was the design awards. The problem with that one was that it just, all the timing went weird. And so I ended up sat in this horrible little green room with no windows or anything for about 4 hours. Just thinking, what am I doing? You know, because they split the award show into two halves. So I did the first like half hour, and that was fine. Then I had to sit in this green room for 4 hours. So I just listened to you doing your Tom Hanks Nerdist podcast, which was amazing.
Which one?
The first one, and then the second one.
Well, we got to give credit to Tom Hanks on that one.
Yeah.
He was fucking awesome from start to finish.
He's so, I mean, obviously he is like super talented and he's a megastar. So, and also the intimidating thing about him is that you can hear that he could quite easily be a very good stand-up as well, don't you think?
Well, did you ever see Punchline?
No, I've never seen it, but I heard you talking about that. Yeah, and he's good on it, is he?
Well, he's good. I mean, the
movie's okay.
Yeah.
But he's good in it, but he does. He has the comic gene, is that he'll just start riffing and he.
Yeah, yeah. When he's doing that whole Willie Mays that he was talking about?
It was Don't Touch Them.
Yeah.
Some baseball guy. Babe Ruth or I don't know.
No, it wasn't Babe Ruth. It was, I don't know if it was Willie.
Those are the only two baseball guys I know.
You have a computer in front of you, Katie. What are you scratching your chin for? Like, you don't know how you're going to divine this information. It's blasting caps.
Blasting caps.
Don't touch them. Did you do what I suggested in the email on the award show?
Go fuck yourself.
No.
I just like that.
It's really amazing.
Paint my knob gold and pull that out as a special award.
Yeah, at the end, just go, I have one final presentation to make. And then we have one final award to give out. And then you take your gold, your dick out after you paint the gold.
My golden knob.
I mean,
it would be good. It would be good if you could become tumescent before you did it. Otherwise, what? It might be underwhelming. They might think they're getting a special award.
One of two things would happen. Number one, you would get to host everything in Britain from then on. Or number two, you'd never have to host anything in Britain from then on.
Host everything from prison.
I think it would be fine. But you guys, your content, you're so much more. You're so much cooler about what type of content is okay to broadcast
in the UK
on regular television.
What kind of thing are you thinking about?
Well, I mean, it's there's here. You know, American TV will show a lot of violence,
right?
But you know, in terms of like language or like in terms of comedy on main broadcast television,
yeah.
You know, we're really like, you can't say that.
Yeah. Well, the thing is that in the UK. As far as I'm concerned, anyway, I might be wrong about this, but most of the American stuff we get exposed to is the best of the American stuff. So we see all the HBO shows, and that's how people think of American TV, is all those brilliant HBO shows, and then Breaking Bad and everything else, you know, and The Walking Dead. But so we grew up when I was younger watching Seinfeld and the Larry Sanders Show, and so Seinfeld was just mind-blowing because it was so different and so tight and funny, but obviously it wasn't, and it was still edgy material-wise, you know, in some ways, in a very clever way. But on Larry Sanders, you had the language as well, and so I heard the C word on that show before I'd heard it on any other show in the UK.
Wow. We beat you to the C word punch? I can't believe it.
I don't know if you did or not, but that was the first time I'd seen it anyway. Yeah.
You've never seen Chris so proud to be an American.
Good job, America! That's their word!
And that was really edgy, and there was a lot of moments in there where you thought, Larry Sanders I'm talking about, where you thought, oh my God, I can't believe they're allowed to say all this stuff. And a lot of Jeffrey Tambor's bits as Hank, you know, were very close.
Well, that was, you know, that was on, was that Showtime?
No, it was HBO.
Well, it was HBO.
Yeah, you're thinking of the It's Gary Shandling
Gary
show.
Gary Shandling show was on Showtime, that's right. So, you know,
that was great, too.
That was really start when cable television really kind of started to become a viable alternative to network television. Like, oh, they can take risks and they can swear and they can, you know, do things that regular television won't dare to do. So, it was a fun time kind of watching that happen, and continues to happen in cable.
Yeah.
I don't know how broadcast television is going to sustain.
Well, I mean, now it's, now of course the whole fun of swearing is been diminished somewhat because it's overused or everyone's got in on the act.
But you still, it's funny is even though you think that we're like that here, if you know, on broadcast, it's like still the FCC will still go after people for, you know, oh, they said fuck in an award show and it slipped through. And
yeah, that's
they still
weird,
make
isn't
a it? Big deal out of it.
Yeah, you've got to pick your moment.
Yeah. Well, it gives people who don't have anything to do something to do by complaining. And
yeah, I guess the idea is that you know, there are certain audiences who expect one kind of thing, and you don't want to expose people who are just watching with their kids or I don't know what to stuff that's going to freak them out. But I mean, it's so weird anyway now. People say, do people say shit on primetime TV?
No. They can't. You
a couple times on cable, right?
On cable, so like because the cable isn't regulated the same way that broadcast television is regulated.
Yeah.
So cable television, any channel in cable television can really say whatever it wants. The reason that they don't is because of sponsors. So, you know, you can in theory, like, you know, on Walking Dead, they could be like, "Holy fucking fuck!" And it would be legally fine.
Yeah.
But the audience might complain and the sponsors might complain. And so there is sort of a self-imposed standards and practices that works, you know, with whoever's sponsoring the television. HBO obviously doesn't have to because it's a subscription. So you don't, you know, fuck it. You can watch it or you don't watch it.
Exactly.
But I've noticed that like on Mad Men or Breaking Bad or Walking Dead, they'll get one, I think they get one shit per show.
Oh, they're bursting.
Yeah.
But they'll take out fuck. They'll
take out fuck. Yeah, they'll drop out fuck. Because that was the big thing with the last episode of the last season of Walking Dead. Andrew Lincoln did a bunch of takes where he said, like, they fucked with the wrong people or they don't know who they're fucking with or whatever. Yeah. And then they did one take where they said screwing, and he really wanted, like, I think they really wanted it to be fuck, but then in the end it was like, you know, I'm just not sure that we're really, yeah. I don't know if we can jump to there, and so they let
it. It's the biggest show on cable. I think they could have just done one fuck.
They're allowed one fuck.
It would have blown shit up.
It would have blown shit up.
But back to what you were saying about how you guys were getting, like, you know, HBO shows and, you know, like, American television is so great. I remember it was about 2005 or 6 is when I started being able to see a lot of British stuff, like Channel 4 stuff, where, like, I became aware of, you know, Garth Marenghi's Dark Place and Nathan Barley and all the Chris Moore stuff, Time Trumpet, Look Around You. It was just this, like, it was like 2006 or 5 where I just started getting all this. I was like, just convinced that England had the best television in the world. And then someone described me, they're like, well, you know how they probably only see HBO shows.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
they have a lot of shit shows too.
That's what I discovered.
I mean, I think all those shows you mentioned are, you know, folks like us, the nerds, we know them and love them. But for the vast majority of people, they're cult shows, really. Yeah. It's Time Trumpet. You know, not many people saw Time Trumpet. And even Garth Marenghi, as great as it was, you know, that was a show that not that many people were aware of.
Yeah.
And it was like our show. It was like a little secret club for people to be in. That's part of the fun of it, really. And that's why a lot of those shows never made it beyond one or two series.
Yeah.
But, you know, for mainstream stuff, yeah, it's a lot of it is quite, well, we call it end of the pier kind of comedy. You know what I mean? Like, very broad and... laugh tracks and big wobbly sets. And
what's the state of British television now?
I mean, it's the same sort of thing. You know, there's good stuff out there and you can find it. And I put a show called Hunderbee on your drive there. Have you heard of that one?
No.
Julia Davis, do you know who she is? She's in, you'd recognize her if you saw her. She's brilliant. She's one of the funniest female comedians around. She was in Big Train and she was in a series called Human Remains with Rob Brydon.
I've heard of it.
And anyway, she's brilliant. And she did this show where it's sort of a period piece, but she did it like they shot it with available light, you know, Kubrick style, with all these special lenses. In fact, I think they even used the same kind of lenses that Kubrick did, and it was all like candlelight and everything. It was beautifully made, but it's also really weird and very amusingly written, and she's amazingly funny in it. Anyway, so there's things like that which are very good, and there's always funny people popping up. There's Claudia O'Doherty, you know her? No. I mean, she's not a Brit, she's Australian, but she's doing more and more stuff in the UK. She's very funny, and she pops up on Channel 4 every now and again. Channel 4 is still pretty good about getting behind new comedy.
What's the pitch process for, like, how do you get a show made? And do they do pilots, or do
you're
they
asking
just
the wrong guy? I mean,
a lot comes from radio there, right?
Yes, that's true. A lot of big shows do come from Radio 4. Radio 4 does a lot of very good comedy, and so people like Mitchell and Webb, do you know them?
Yes, of course.
So they came out of Radio 4 in the same way that shows like Brass Eye and The Day Today did. Well, not Brass Eye so much, but The Day Today was from on the hour on Radio 4.
Oh!
Yeah. And
fucking love The Day Today and Brass Eye.
Yeah.
But the first time I saw The Day Today, it was just like,
I know, it was amazing, wasn't it? When I was at art school at the time, and I hadn't even, and The Day Today wasn't on, but on the hour was. And I was doing the same sort of, I was on, you know, I was in the same Venn diagram kind of thing, of news parodies that I was doing, but mine were awful, you know. But it was the same sort of thing of playing with the language and words and doing, you know, lampooning the inanity of a lot of local news broadcasters.
I love the thing you did with the Pope.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Pope. That was so great.
New Pope. I had fun. That came off the back of doing Time Trumpet with Amanda Iannucci and him letting me, because that was a BBC show, so I was able to raid the BBC archives and do use a lot of footage and revoice it and recut it and do these kind of science fiction commentaries on state funerals and things like that.
It was great. It was just the Pope being crowned. What do you say?
No, it was the funeral of
Pope. But it was just all these different people, and like it was all the voiceover was just acting like it was a galactic conference, and just every time it would show another person, it would just be like, "This is, you know, this person from this galaxy."
It was good fun. Yeah. So yeah, we were doing. What was I saying before? It was about the.
You said time trip. You're talking about day to day. The first time you saw.
Oh yeah, so day to day, yeah. And so someone at college said like, "Hey, you know, you should listen to this show on the hour. I think you'd like it." It was one of those things that I think, looking back on it, they were sort of going, "You know, your stuff's a little bit shit. You need a wake up call. Someone's doing it much much better than you." And here it is. And so I listened to that, and you get it's that weird feeling of like half of your heart sinking, and you're like, "No." And the rest of your heart soaring because you're thinking, "Oh my God, this is amazing." And then the day to day came out, and that was so funny. And you thought, well, they're never going to be able to make news programs the same again because this has totally destroyed all those stupid, lazy conventions. And but instead, it had the effect of convincing a whole generation of journalists and newsmakers and TV program makers who grew up loving that show. It seemed as if they were using it as a blueprint for what they should do. So now it's like, well, the day to day was like Fox News before Fox News almost, wasn't it?
Well, and it was Daily Show-esque, but in the sense that the episodes were evergreen and it really was more of a satire without the direct current event social messaging.
Right.
At the same time, it was really just this is a generic. This is sort of this generic type of show.
Yeah.
And here's a bunch of nonsense. And that show must have been, was that like 93 or 94? I mean, it's
something like that. Yeah. And but all the stuff with the graphics, you know, the layers and layers of ridiculous graphics that went on forever. That absolutely predicted the way that TV went then for the next 10 years.
What was that Charlie Brooker sketch where he was just talking about like field pieces?
Oh, it's that's like great, isn't it?
It's
yeah.
Like, you know, like a drab dressed man and walking towards the camera using his hands to make points goes and cuts to an interview with some idiot. And it just cuts to the guy going like, "I don't know what I'm talking about or why they would interview me for anything."
Yeah. Yeah, that's brilliant.
So
isn't
you
it?
Love that. You love the convention of taking existing things and then just repurposing them.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is laziness and watching too much TV. You know, like for a while, it's difficult now with Sky boxes and stuff to actually transfer the material from the box to your computer. You know what I mean? Like if you saw something on TV, the actual physical process of getting it off your Digibox.
Oh yeah,
and making a copy that you can then manipulate on your computer is quite a pain in the ass, isn't
yeah.
it? Anyway, sometimes, I mean, now in the HD world, you can just download stuff from the internet and manipulate it like that, and that's fun. But yeah, it's just watching crap and thinking, oh yeah, if I just changed a couple of little bits, that would be funny.
What was it like to work with Radiohead?
Oh man,
you did Jigsaw.
How long did you last before asking?
About 40 minutes. I started to dip into a little bit when I was like, so we did Radiohead. I'm like, I should ask now.
Yeah, that's funny. Isn't that? That's a coincidence that you. I never made the connection with you and Radiohead.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. That was 2004. We made that. I think
that was really funny. Yeah. I think it was even someone that Nigel Godrich was working with, a band called Travis, who sent me that Radiohead.
Travis stuff. Sent you that?
Yeah, wow. Yeah.
I fucking love Travis.
That's crazy.
yeah, well, they Travis are really the reason that I got to know Nigel and then Radiohead, because years ago, me and Joe were having our makeup done for some photo shoot by the lead singer of Travis's girlfriend, Nora, and I got chatting to her while we were sitting in the makeup chair, and she said, "Oh, my boyfriend's in a band. They're called Travis." I was like, "Oh, I've not heard of them. They were just starting out." And so anyway, I said, "Well, you should come. We're having a rap party. You should come along to the party." And so she came, and she brought Fran and Dougie from the band Travis, and they were really nice Glasgow guys. We got on very well. And then we went to see them play and met Nigel, who was producing their record, their second record, The Man Who. And I knew who Nigel Godrich was, obviously being a big Radiohead fan. So I was very in awe of him. And also, he just produced the Pavement album, Terror Twilight.
Terror Twilight, great one.
Which I really love, you know, and I think that Pavement purists sometimes turn their nose up because
they hated it.
Yeah, and they think that he took all the rough edges off them. And
yeah, they don't even really play songs from that when they were doing the reunion tours.
I mean, those songs are brilliant, though.
Yeah, they're great.
I don't understand it because, you know, it sounds... Often this happens, I think, with a lot of the people that Nigel produces, is that they go on after they've stopped working with him, and it sounds like they're still trying to recreate the sound that he did for them. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. Beck's new album sounds as if he is... And he produced it himself, I think, Beck, right? Yeah. Morning Phase. But it sounds exactly like Sea Change, to like almost as if he's trying to recreate all the little burbles and all Nigel's little echoplex things that he does. Anyway, I digress. So got to know Nigel, and then and that was around the time of Kid A. So Nigel was very protective of Radiohead. They were in that post OK Computer world of super secrecy and not really enjoying their sudden exposure and you know, going to the next level. I think they all found it quite difficult. And I saw that film, Meeting People Is Easy, about them, you know, and it was very exciting, I remember, at the time, because it seemed as if Thom Yorke was right on the point of maybe losing it, you know, in 97. And you thought, oh, no, I hope he keeps it together, because it really, especially in that film, it was constructed in such a way that you thought, shh, this is an accident waiting to happen, this guy, you know. But actually, all they were doing was pulling back a little bit and being a bit more secretive, doing Kid A and stuff. But yeah, Nigel, you know, Travis were Nigel's kind of pop project, and Radiohead were his sort of special indie art project kind of thing, and he kept them very separate. So I didn't meet any of the Radiohead people for a long time, but then we came to a show in LA, in fact, and they were playing at the Greek.
I was probably at that show.
Yeah, and that was, I think, maybe the first time I'd seen them, and it was amazing. So that was a Kid A tour. Mm-hmm. So that blew my mind, and I remember seeing, we were staying at the Chateau Marmont, and I remember seeing a few of them milling around in the lobby, and the only one, I was, you know, I could have gone up and spoken to any of them, really, because they sort of knew who I was through Nigel. But the only one who I could deal with talking to was Phil, because he seemed smiley. Phil Selway, yeah. And so I chatted to him about, I knew that he worked for the Samaritans, who were this kind of charity in the UK that do a lot of good work for people who are depressed and stuff like that. And like Phil, I think, for a long time actually manned the phones for the Samaritans.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, sometimes it's one of these services where if you're very depressed and maybe you're having suicidal thoughts, you can call this line and you can talk to someone who will just speak to you like a normal person and you know, try and talk you down from the edge, as it were. And Phil actually did this, you know, for a while. And so I was talking to him about that. I was very interested in that. But he was the only one I could actually deal with talking to. The rest of them just seemed too much like scary gods, you know. and then eventually became more pally with Ed, tall guitarist.
Getting closer to Tom.
Yeah, well, Tom,
closer in.
Yeah, circling. Tom, I think I still am a little bit too in awe of Tom. Also, I think he's a very different person. Like, he's not, you know, he's not silly in the same way that I am.
Right.
And I don't know. Yeah, I always feel like he. I don't want to irritate him.
Somewhere on a hard drive, when I used to work for Wired, they did a piece where Tom interviewed David Byrne.
Oh, yeah, that's right. And I was there when he did that.
I have the full unedited audio, and they only used a clip, you know, like they used smaller clips for the website, but I actually have somewhere I have the full unedited audio. And there are parts of it where Tom just said, because, you know, he obviously worshiped Talking Heads.
Yeah.
And there are parts where he just sounds giddy. Just talking to David Byrne, and so it was a different. I'd never really heard him that way before. I don't know. Obviously, I don't know him at all. But I was like, oh yeah, okay, he has fun. He does like things. Okay, good.
Yeah. Oh man, he's a big fan, you know, and he loves Elvis Costello. He's obsessed by they all loved that. Especially Remain in Light was the big album, I think, for Radiohead, and. Yeah, he loves all that stuff. And I was at their studio in Oxford when David Byrne came over. And so that was I sort of spoken to them a couple of times, met them a little bit, good friends with Nigel. He's a lovely guy, but never really felt as if I could sort of properly go up and say hello to the rest of them. But then we went and helped out. When I say we, me and Garth Jennings, a director in the UK, done a lot of great music videos and a couple of features and stuff. And so we went and helped them out with this webcast they did after In Rainbows when mm-hmm. that came out. They did a couple. They did one, I think, the week the album came out, and then one just before Christmas later that year, 2007. And so we went to just help them film a few more little bits and pieces, because they filmed lots of stuff of them performing, because Nigel's a big tech head. He gets all these cameras and stuff off eBay, all these old school video cameras. And he can wire them all, and he can, like, he's doing the circuits. And, I mean, he's really an amazing guy. And so he hooked up this whole little CCTV system with all these old school video cameras in their studio outside Oxford, and filmed all these performances of them playing the tracks on In Rainbows. And then me and Garth just filmed them in some slightly different ways, performing some of the other tracks. So we went up to the top of a hill nearby and filmed them playing Falstaff, Tom and Johnny. And then we did a... And then I brought along these helmets that I'd fitted with... I'd put poles on them and put little security cameras at the end, and so that they would film their faces. It was kind of like GoPro before GoPro, I suppose. And then I'd done a few bits with this, with these helmets myself, and it produces a funny effect where your head remains motionless, yes, and everything around you swims around, you know. So I knew it was a funny effect, and I thought, oh, this would look good if Radiohead were wearing them. But it was, we were nervous that, you know, it was like, who's going to ask them, kind of thing, because they look stupid. And they look goofy, and you still think, well, you know, they're kind of a cool band. They at that point, they hadn't been in any of their videos. Like, they just gradually stopped being in their videos after OK Computer. Or even after the Bends. I mean, were they in there? Oh, Tom was in some of the OK Computer videos.
Right?
Yeah. But the whole band, I think, hadn't been in a video for a long time. So we were nervous about suggesting doing these silly ideas, you know. But they were cool about it, and very open-minded and relaxed. And they all immediately got the idea of what the effect would be like, and played up to it. Like, each one of them so gratifyingly played up to how it would look best, like swinging their heads around. And Tom, who does his wobbly head dance anyway, but that just looked amazing with the helmet camera on. So we did two takes of them miming to the track. Well, they were playing it in the thing, but they were playing along to the track. And that was perfect. And then me and Garth just sat there the rest of that night editing it. We kept on cutting back to Phil, I remember, because Phil has got this incredibly intense expression. This was Jigsaw Falling Into Place, was the track they were playing. And every time we wanted to sort of get the energy out, we'd cut back to Phil, because he just looks as if he's about to explode. But that was amazing fun, you know. And it was, I think that was my favorite track on the record as well, or one of them. So I just thought, this is, it doesn't get better than this.
And then the Seven parody.
Yes, that was Garth's idea. And he said, oh, we should do the bit where, you know, Morgan Freeman finds the head in the box in Seven and stick Tom's head in there.
But it's really, it's brilliant the way that it's done, because it's like, because the box is closed, and you hear, and then he opens up a big head, and then it's Tom's fucking head,
yeah,
just in the box, just singing, just like, just the way Tom is. And then, you know, Morgan Freeman has a moment where he's looking over at Brad Pitt, and he's freaking, and then he just closed the box, and it just,
what's in the box? What's in the box?
Yeah, it was great. And that was one of the moments where I thought, oh, he's not going to go for this, because Garth was pitching that one to Tom and saying, well, look, we'll stick your head in this box, and we'll put, like, bits of crap around it, and, you know, packing peanuts or whatever, and it'll look really good. And Tom was like, I don't know about this. And he said, have you got any makeup and stuff? And we're like, no, not really. And Tom was like, God, you know. Because he's really, they're all very easygoing and unprecious. But still, like any normal person, there are moments where they sort of remember, oh, millions of people might see this, kind of thing.
Right.
And they probably will. So it'd be nice not to look like complete twats.
I wonder what that thing is, though, where they, you know, where bands all of a sudden get famous. This sort of the Pearl Jam thing, too, is like, or the Nirvana. There's like, they get super famous and they're like, I don't want this. And they're like, what were you doing the whole time? You were like, is it just, did they think like, no, we'll just play in rock clubs forever? And yeah. Then, like, do you think the fame part gets in the way, or do you think they feel guilty because they're like, we shouldn't be this popular, or if we are this popular, we're not cool anymore, or the business part sucks?
All of the above. Absolutely. All those things, I think, are just the reality of them is completely different to what you imagine. You know, you just think of all the fun bits, don't you, when you're starting out, whatever you're doing. And then if you have any degree of success, I think the reality of that and all the fact that it makes you feel a bit of a fraud and a bit of a phony, and the fact that it's very easy to believe negative criticism and very hard to believe compliments, you know, all those things just make life a little bit less fun. And you think, oh, why is life less fun? I mean, I'm saying all this as if it's happened to me. It's not happened to me in any...
Do you think you'd be okay with it?
I mean, you get little... Every now and again, you get little tastes when you skirt the cusp of something that's about to cross over or whatever. And I think probably not. No, I quite... I really enjoy life in the margins. Everyone's nice to you. the people that come to your shows are really into it, and they're not just... You know, I really feel like it's pretty hardcore if you're on TV and you get any success and you get a whole group of people who are sort of, oh, yeah, you're that guy. You did that thing. Yeah, I'll come to your show. And they're like, oh, this is a bit shit and weird. And I think then you get to the position where, you pull back a little bit, the same way that people like Stuart Lee did and a lot of, well, a few British comedians who just thought, oh, I don't want to have any of that, really. I want to have my nice, dedicated audience and who know what they're going to get. And I don't want to have to deal with a whole bunch of yobs who don't know what the deal is, kind of thing.
I like the word yobs. I like the word yobs. It's nice. It's almost like shortening yahoos. Like all these yahoos, all these yobs.
Yeah, I think yahoos is the same, right? It's not like, it's not, you're not being... What are yahoos? Yahoos is sort of beard up random guys, right?
Yeah, I think it's the sort of like
outer city people.
I think colloquially it became these kind of random people who don't, you know, these sort of one dimensional, like, hey, what's going on? You know, like, yahoo, everything, woo! You know, like, you don't really know what it is that they...
Yeah.
I don't mean that they have to be Southern. I just mean,
no,
like,
sure.
They're sort of...
They could be Australian, like Yahoo Serious.
Exactly. Well, I like his British contemporary Yob Serious much better. I thought that was going to be funnier.
I really...
As it was coming out of my mouth, I was like, this is too labored.
You didn't?
No.
Did I not give you enough?
No, but I didn't deserve enough.
Mom, Dad, come on, hey. Please. You're both great.
I liked it. I couldn't do that. Look at this.
You're so brave. You're so brave to get up there and make that yob joke. I don't know how you do it.
I thought it was funny.
You're looking very handsome. Have you been running?
But was the show funny? So you've been running? People want to say something.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, I don't want to talk about... Obviously can't say I didn't really enjoy the... I'll just say something positive. Yeah.
This venue's pretty big.
Yeah. Where'd you get that shirt?
Oh, that's
good. Good shirt. I quite liked performing in England, though. I really want to go back and do more. It'd be nice if I had something there that would... Because just like you, it is a tremendous expense to go over and to put on a show. That'd be nice if I had more stuff going on there, just enough to kind of help justify...
But you could on the back of this podcast, couldn't you? I mean, the podcast thing is just amazing. That's changed the way... I think of everything that I do, really, because there's such a dedicated core of people now that have got to... Well, the people that do know my stuff, and me and Joe, are so passionate about it because of the podcast and the radio show that we used to do, I think, much more than our TV show. You know, there's still a few oldies that come up to me every now and again and say, oh, yeah, the Adam and Joe show, I used to like that. But But the people that really stay in touch and I think that mainly come to my shows are the people that connected because of the podcast, you know. Like at immigration yesterday, I got into a conversation with one of the guys. I was stood at, just about to go through immigration and I was thinking, God, why do they get the most miserable, angry-looking people to work at immigration? It's so depressing. But as I was thinking that, this guy said, so what do you do? What are you in the country for? And I said, oh, I'm a, and I thought, oh, this question, you know, yeah. What am I going to do? How am I going to explain?
I'm a comedian. It's always weird to say you're a comedian.
Yeah, because I'm a comedian. And so I said, oh, I write sort of comedy stuff. And you kind of, you give like the most, you give the most sort of popular version of yourself, the most successful version of yourself that you can. Oh, I write comedy for the BBC. you know the BBC. And he's like, oh, really? So he's impressed by that. And he very quickly said, I love listening to podcasts with the comedians talking about the whole business of comedy. I was like, oh, do you? Yeah, I love that too. That's great. The sort of intimate connection you make, the way they get in your head is one of the things I love about podcasts. And he said, yeah, that's true. It's amazing, isn't it? I'm thinking about them all. Who did he like? Greg Fitzsimmons?
Greg Fitzsimmons.
Yeah. He was into him. And I said, I'm going to be on The Nerdist this week. And he's like, oh, wow, that's a good show, too. I like those guys. And
I feel like this is some weird terrorist test. If someone's like, what is a podcast? Get him! You know, like...
Remember that time I flew from Jamaica to D.C.? And like I was in Jamaica for 8 hours. I had to fly to D.C. because we had a show.
Yeah.
And I got brought into smaller and smaller rooms because of the suspect nature of being in Jamaica for 8 hours. and then going to the nation's capital right away.
How long were you there? 8 hours.
Yeah.
And you're going to Washington, D.C. now?
Yes.
so fucking suspect.
And like I kept on getting brought into smaller and smaller rooms and like, you know, the guy kept on asking me, what were you doing in Jamaica? I was like, it's my girlfriend's sister's wedding. And then like, you know, asked me what I did. I was like, and I'm like a comedy writer, but why are you going to D.C.? For a show. I'd see you writing on a show that, and you know, I have to keep on.
Yeah.
And then I was getting real confused. And then like I said, he's like, then one more time, why are you going to D.C.? Or why were you in Jamaica? And I said, for my sister's girlfriend's wedding. And I'm like, and the guy's like, oh no. So, interesting,
but deviance.
Then, yeah. And then I was like, no. He's like, your story changed. I was like, no. I meant, sorry. I'm just.
Oh, did he actually say your story changed? Oh my
he's
god.
Like, so why? He's like, I was like, I'm in a podcast. We booked the show afterwards, and he's like, oh, podcast. What's it called? And I said, it's called The Nerdist. He's like, oh, I can't believe I didn't tell you that. Oh, Nerdist. I love Chris Hardwick. Talking Dead's my jam.
Oh shit!
Yeah, wow, yeah.
That was his jam.
That was his
I don't
jam.
Think you can jam to that show.
You can't. But it was like, and then I got to go.
The being recognized by the podcast, because the people say like, oh, I love Talking Dead. I go, well, that's awesome, you know. But it's on a television network, and you know. But I'm always so delighted when people. I was in rural Georgia because I was there for Walking Dead stuff, and I went to a grocery store. And this guy sitting out front was like, hey, I love the podcast. And it just sort of freaked me out. I'm like, I can't believe we do this thing that just feels like...
It's just here.
You know, we're doing it on little DIY stuff. It's just us. We're just fucking around and hanging out. Yeah. And I can walk into a random grocery store in the middle of Georgia and some guy's like, hey, I love the podcast. Like, that's still... I understand how the internet works and it still freaks me out.
Well, it's such an enjoyable part of my life now to listen to podcasts. And it's so great. You know, I think, God, what was it like before? Maybe, I don't know what I was doing before, but maybe like conversing with other humans in three dimensions.
Gross.
But it's something I really look forward to, you know. And Mark Maron has said a few times on his podcast, you know, that he feels as if he has his longest and most meaningful conversations in his life on that podcast, you know.
Sure.
It's the only time really that you're sat and able to converse with other people at leisure for such a long time.
Yeah.
And conversely, for people listening as well, it's probably the only time they hear other people talking at length about anything. It's
well,
really
that's
nice.
True. Even
know?
Like you know, we will do episodes where it's just the three, you know, me, Chris, and Matt. And those, like, we look forward to them because it's this kind of like moment for us to force into just like hanging out as friends,
yeah.
Which is so rare because we're all so busy. And it's just like because of the podcast, which people enjoy, but it's like it's a nice opportunity just to hang out.
Well, the truth of the matter is that it takes energy to focus mm-hmm. on a conversation. and the podcast gives you a reason. I this is going to sound bad. It gives you a reason to do that. You should do that in life.
Yeah.
But a lot of times when you're hanging out with friends, you're in a group, and your mind is sort of on the rest of your day. It's like, oh, I got to get this done. I got to get this email. But when we do the podcast, like, phones go off. We sit down. We know we have to talk for a certain amount of time. And it really does force you, you know, with good result, to talk and get to know people and explore, rather than just like, oh yeah, I'm sorry, I gotta, you know,
yeah.
Thing. There's never a time in a podcast where it's like, wait, what were you saying? This, you know, because you're there, you're in it.
Yeah,
yeah, it's good. I really like it, and I've got little routines and things like during the week. I love drinking alcohol. I don't know if you've heard of alcohol.
What is big that? Fan. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
He was too big a fan.
Oh, yeah.
Alcohol took out a restraining order. Yes.
You got off the alcohol bus.
I didn't get sober. It wasn't on me.
No, I can't come within 50 feet.
That's a shame. You're missing out. It's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
I tried to tell it. Wouldn't you know? I was shaking it and like, why won't you love me?
Yeah, it gets awkward because like I'm still really close with alcohol,
right?
And like it's always
does
like,
it ask about me?
Yeah.
Have you tried smoking cigarettes? They're brilliant as well.
I used to do that, but I had to stop that.
But anyway, me and my wife try and restrict our alcohol intake during the week, just as like a little fun competition, to stop ourselves going totally off the rails. But
it's my favorite kind of drinking game.
Yeah. But I allow myself to cheat when certain podcasts come out. Like for a while I got into Todd Barry's podcast, and I really would enjoy, like, if I saw it, it would come out on a Wednesday for it. He's been a bit slack recently because he's been promoting his crowd work tour. So they haven't been very regular, but for a while they were coming out every Wednesday or Thursday, and it would be like, oh, good. And I would lie to my wife that I was going to do some work. I was like, oh, I'm going to go back in the office and finish something off, so you go to bed, I'll see you later. And this is actually true. I'm admitting this for the first time. And so I would go, having lied to my wife, God, I'm pathetic, into my office, and I would listen to Todd's podcast, the Toddcast. I don't know why he doesn't call it the Toddcast, but there you go.
I told Todd Glass the same thing. Why didn't you call it the Toddcast?
Yeah.
The Todd Glassed.
Todd Glassed is good.
Right, the Todd Glassed. Brilliant. Anyway, and, you know, crack open a couple of tinnies, sit there in my nutty room listening to Todd crapping on to whoever he was talking to. And he's very, like, he's got such a soothing voice, and it's really relaxing, and, oh, it's great.
That's very nice.
Yeah, it's a lovely routine, and I really look forward to it. I got quite annoyed when he became irregular with his podcasts.
I gotta go just drink in my office. Yeah. I mean, work!
Paperclips. Paperclips.
Yeah, it was, now she knows, so there's the end of that routine.
Yeah. Just find a different podcast.
Yeah.
Exactly. No, it's got to be Todd.
It's got to be Todd.
Got to be Todd.
Whereas Nerdist, I tend to consume while I'm traveling. Like, there are certain podcasts for certain things. I find that WTF is good for manual labor. Nerdist is good.
Just soak in Mark's anger and just use it for doing things.
Yeah, exactly. Or when he is being beyond the pale himself as a person, yeah, you can just hammer in the nails a little bit harder. yeah, it's great. I love podcasts. They're fantastic.
Yeah, they're fun to do.
They are.
When are you? When is your show? Is your show tonight?
Well, so I'm doing a little spot at UCB tonight, doing a wonderful Nerd Melt on Wednesday. And then my full show is on the Sunday. This is coming Sunday at the Mac Senate Studios, I think.
Nice. Right. Wait, Sunday?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. I thought it was Monday.
No. Sunday, I think.
Well, I can't make that.
Oh, why? What's so important?
I'm out of town.
Oh. Why is that unnecessary?
That's a bummer.
Seeing your sister's girlfriend.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. D.C.
Yeah.
You got to go to Columbia for 8 hours. And then straight to D.C.
Exactly. My sister's sister's getting married.
Hey, change your start.
I'm marrying my sister. What?
What?
Hey. I'm getting corny. So you're in town for another...
Yeah, for a week. I'll be leaving this time next week. Considering maybe applying for a upgrade to premium economy on the way back.
Treat yourself.
How much would that be, do you reckon?
I don't know.
$700.
Oh, mate, you're joking, aren't you?
That's a pretty
like
good
twice
guess.
The yeah. economy ticket price.
Yeah. I upgrade to mid-level all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You should try. You try. It'll be worth it.
Have you ever been upgraded like without paying? Like, do you get lots of frequent flyer miles?
I have a ton of frequent flyer miles.
So shouldn't you be being upgraded?
He doesn't need to. If he got upgraded, he'd be the pilot of the plane.
Right.
I
can't get more first class.
Are you getting flown around first class, you twat?
I mean, yeah. It's pretty rad.
Oh, my God.
Well, you know, he needs the room.
Yeah. That's true. Well, you're all very tall. I'm the smallest person in this room apart from the
dog. Do you know why? I started paying for that long before I could afford it for two reasons. Number one, I used to have really, really, really bad, like, my back would go out to the extent that I couldn't walk for a couple of days. And the thing that helped cure that was exercise and strengthening the core, as they say. I was very weak and I was in bad shape. And then I got into good shape. And so that really helped. But I was traveling so much that it was taking me several days to recover every time I was coming home.
Right.
And so I was, in addition to that, I didn't like flying just as a concept.
Yeah, because it's not logical, is it?
It is. So it's
against God's will.
I mean, it's just the way it is. I mean, he's just waiting up there to start flicking them down with his giant hand that comes out of a cloud, because that's how that works. He lives in the clouds. So I said, I'm going to start paying for this thing that I shouldn't be paying for yet, because A, it will make me look forward to traveling. It'll help me get over flying. And it will inspire me to work harder so that it's not so much of an expense.
So it's not going to cripple you financially.
Yeah, probably a very fiscally irresponsible thing to do. But I turned it into this sort of game of like, I'm going to make this a thing that kind of motivates me to work harder so that so the traveling becomes enjoyable.
Yeah.
And so that's what I...
The dream, obviously, is to have other people fly you first class.
Yes.
Yes.
And I would say that is the thing I envy Joe Cornish, my Joe, most for, is the first class travel on someone else's tab. Because, wow, that is like as good as it gets.
But then you don't get to be fringe if you do that. You know that.
Well, exactly. Then you're no longer on the margins.
You don't get to... You don't...
Well, the airline travel is the only time I don't want to be in the margins.
Actually, you want to be well inside.
I want to be the protective. Out of the margins. I want to be out of the aisle. I want to be up there, fully reclined, getting a massage.
So it's just... So as we're sort of wrapping this out, we did it. This flew by. We did an hour and 23 minutes. What is it that ultimately you... You know, what is it that you want? Like, do you want to direct films? Do you want to continue to do live stuff? Do you want to? Is there just sort of intangible thing? Like, I just want more of something. Like, what is it that you want? What do you want to do ultimately?
I would say mainly I want to be upgraded to first class. I mean, that really is that. Honestly, because I genuinely mean that. Like, of all the, because I know a few people who sort of have high profile and high pressure, successful positions or whatever. And I don't envy any aspect of what they do whatsoever, other than possibly the facility they have for getting projects off the ground. I envy that a little bit sometimes. And I also envy the luxury travel because, wow, you know, I'd love to see more of the world and I'd love to be able to take my family around the world and stuff like that a bit more. I have three children and it's always really fun when we go on holiday, but we always go to the same place. So it would be nice. It'd be nice to go to some more adventurous places. But really, that's it. I mean, I feel very lucky. I've got everything that I could want or that I reasonably need. And, you know, I just do my own stuff. And I've got a very nice little audience that come along to things I do most of the time. And, I feel incredibly lucky, I think. It would be nice to, you know, I love films. And Joe and I always... tried to sort of do film stuff together, but it never really we never really got it together to have that good writing dynamic together, you know.
Are you afraid, sort of, this is sort of goes back to the Radiohead thing, are you afraid that when you say like I like being in the margins, are you afraid that the mainstream part gets in the way? Are you superstitious, or do you feel like
I just
it sort of clouds your creative judgment?
No, not at all, because I mean you know, I love lots of mainstream. It's not like I'm a sort of snob or anything. It's not like I'm saying, oh, mainstream sellout shit. You know, I don't think that at all about anyone. But I don't think I've got the chops for it. You know what I mean? Like, I look at the stuff that people do that crosses over to a massive audience, and I think, shit, I don't feel as if I've got that in my bones.
Don't you feel like they feel like that too, though? I feel like everyone feels that.
Oh, really?
That. I think everyone feels that because it's. I think it's just too mind-bendy for people to think that, oh, that's only something that happens to other people. I can't. I don't know what that. I don't. I feel like most people probably think that way. And then when it happens, they're sort of freaked out by what. And I think that's sort of, you know, just in a recursive way plays back into people withdrawing or saying like, I don't deserve this, or this is too strange, or it's too, because I think in their heads they kind of have this idea of like, no, I deserve about this. And any more than that is outside my comfort zone. But I do in general believe that those are self-imposed, that you just sort of like, you just sort of have your own idea about like, nope, this is about what I deserve. Why? I don't know. It just is. And anything beyond that, you're like, too much, too little. Nope. Just get me in this little.
Yeah, town. Maybe it's that. And also, this is about as much as, you know, this is pretty nice. Like if my life carried on the way it is now for a while, then I'd be quite happy. I don't want for that much, really.
Creatively, what more do you want to do?
Oh, yeah. Well, it would be nice to do things at a longer length, like, do something a bit more narrative, perhaps, and something that would just, whether it was a film or a TV show, you know, something that had a bit more substance to it. Like a lot of my stuff is, they're very short, all the bits that I do. And they're really good fun. I love doing them. But it would be nice to do, yeah, something a little bit more robust.
It's going to happen. And here's the thing. You're hearing it. Do you remember that you will come back to this podcast when it happens? But at a certain point, you'll make a thing, and to you, it'll be like, oh, this is nothing. This is a dumb little thing. I'm just gonna, and then you're going to be like, what?
Yeah. I'm going to get drunk.
Todd, it's Adam Buxton. Please release a podcast. I need to go in my office and drink. I can't do it unless you.
I'm going
to
get absolutely. Here's my plan from now on. I'm going to get absolutely drunk. Everything's going to go wrong. I'm going to start treating my family badly. Then I'm going to go back on the Nerdist. And it'll be a horrible and very excruciating exchange that I have. And then I'll start crying. And then all my problems will come out in public. And then I'll take over from Marc Maron.
You have a nice podcast. Little, or he's like, you just made £5 million. Well, I just have to hire Todd Barry just so he does these podcasts. Yeah. So they keep me. He's like your own personal podcaster.
Yeah, right.
You're fine. Another.
Well, it's really good to see you, and it's been nice to, you know, we've sort of become pals via email and on social media, so it's nice to see you in person.
Yeah, same
welcome
here.
To our land.
Thanks so much for having me. You know, I think I must be probably the least well-known person that you've ever had on The Nerdist. So
oh, come on. I'm on here every time.
appreciate it.
No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yes,
no,
I'm
glossing.
So
I'm trying to gloss over that a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Good point.
All right. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Enjoy your burrito. Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast was brought to you by Squarespace.com, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website or blog.
For a free trial and 10% off, go to Squarespace.com, use the offer code Nerdist to show your support to the Nerdist Podcast. We thank them for their support.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.